You're listening to sermon audio from Christchurch Hawthorne in Melbourne. We hope and pray this helps you grow in your knowledge and love of God and enables you to see how great God is.
For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith, for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and righteousness of men, whom by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, for God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world, in things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honour him as God or give thanks to him. But they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man, and birds, and animals, and creeping things. Therefore God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonouring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed for ever. Amen. For this reason God gave them up to dishonourable passions, for their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature, and the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another. Men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. They were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them.
Well, if this is going to do any good at all, we're going to need to pray. So let's do that. Father, we hear lots of words, as you know, and we're not all that good at listening at the end of the day, and we pray that you would help us to learn important things. I pray that you would stop me from saying things that are just my opinion and things that aren't true. Pray that you would make us able to hear your voice through your word, that it would cut through all the years of conditioning we've received, and that you would help us to understand and believe those things that are real and true. And we ask for your blessing and your help that we may live well in our day. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, you might know the title of tonight's talk has been stolen from a book. And it was this: If There Is a God, Why Are There Atheists? To run that the other way, since there is no God, why do people believe in God? That was the... Well, it wasn't even asked at the convention because it's known. Atheists have known. I knew it when I was an atheist. We all know why, because there's no God, why people believe in God. It's because they're psychological cripples. They need to grow up. They need to get over this invisible friend in the sky. All this sort of nonsense. You grew out of Santa Claus. You grew out of the Tooth Fairy. Crying out loud at some stage, grow up and realize, yes, you are alone in the universe. Get used to it. Live realistically. Atheists rarely ask, why is it that no adult comes from not believing in Santa Claus and as an adult begins to believe in Santa Claus, which lots of people do with God? I mean, it's a cute parallel, but it's hopelessly inaccurate. But it's one of those things you say when you already know what the answer is. So the answer that people give, and it's one that I find it somewhat ironic when people do it to me, and it irritates me when people assume that they are psychologically stronger than I am. Now, they might be, but they very rarely have any evidence to base it. It's just an assumption that atheists have been taught that is, that believers are slightly weaker people than they, and they just need to get stronger. Now, as I understand it, this idea began from a guy called Feuerbach a few hundred years ago, and it's interesting how many of us are highly indebted to thinkers that we've never heard of. But Feuerbach seems to be the first guy who came up with this idea, and he argued that when people think they're doing theology, they're actually doing anthropology. When they think they're talking about God, they're really talking about humans. And what humans do is we project into the cosmos a father figure, a kindly, warm, etc., etc., etc. We believe that when you die, unless you're Adolf Hitler, Feuerbach didn't say much about Hitler, but he would have. But, you know, that if unless you're really, 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 really seriously wicked, like if you're a Liberal Party supporter, if you're Julia, or if you're a Labour player, Tony, those people, you're okay. But all the rest of us will kind of go to heaven. And so it's a whole lot of things to comfort you. That's what it's about. Marx picks this up. Freud believes this. It comes into our world. So when I became a Christian in 1974... just to give you some clue about how ancient I am. My older brother, I had two older brothers, but the one who was just ahead of me, he was kind of my hero, Ross, and he was a lovely man then and still is. But I feared talking to him about my becoming a Christian because I knew he didn't like Christianity. So when I was sharing a room with him and had begun to read the Bible, I would keep it tucked under my mattress where you would normally find Playboy or something like that. I kept my, not me, of course, yeah, but, you know, others. But because I knew he didn't like Christianity, and I feared talking to him about it. And when it finally came up, I remember he said to me, it was my first year out of uni, he said, look, Ian, you just come to believe in this God thing because this is a confusing time of life. You've left school, the comfort of school. You've gone to uni for a week and then you've dropped out. You're confused and this is comforting. And I remember saying, oh, no, Russ. I said, this is awful, this being Christian. It's the most miserable experience, because it was. This is the most miserable experience of my life. I'm only in this because it's true. Because my first few months of being Christian were horrible. Everything that made life fun was outlawed to me. And I hadn't even begun to realize how much God was going to change me. But the stuff that I really wanted to and really did, I honestly couldn't see how you could have a life with the stuff that God wouldn't let me do and the stuff he wanted me to do. But it was interesting. That was my brother's immediate response. That this was, it's a comfort thing. And that's why atheists will sometimes say, well, we don't want to take your comfort blanket away from you. And they don't mean to be, but they are accidental. And I was, when I was there, just entirely patronizing. And we're just scared little critters, really. And so that's the, when people say, since there's no God, why do people believe these crazy things? Because they're ignorant cowards, really, etc. Well, they don't use quite those words because they're nasty, and they're not nasty people. This passage actually argues the other question. And in a sense, if you're going to get into psychoanalyzing people, and I did want to ask, I was lined up one time to ask a question, how is it that you can actually see into the mind, not just of the 1.5 billion Christians and the 1. Whatever billion Muslims and the gazillions of Buddhists, etc., but you are so wise, you can read into the hearts of all of us and you can tell why we act? I think it was the answer to that question was obvious. But the Bible actually has something to say about why is it that if there is a God who's clear and big and true, people don't believe in him? Because according to the Bible, it has always been true that right relating to God has been the minority position. This is not something new. It's something ancient. And let's have a look at the passage I thought we might look at is the one that was read from Romans 1. Romans 1. What I might do, just for the sake of the fun of it, I encourage you to have your Bibles open, if that's what you'd like to do. If you prefer listening without, that's fine too. I'm going to actually use a slightly different translation, not just to be a pest, but just so you can see how the whole translation is a non-issue. I was talking with someone today at the atheist convention. Oh, sometimes we don't know what the original is. Oh, baloney. Seriously, when they made me learn Greek, to become an Anglican minister was a complete waste of time. So there's no great, except when JW is quoted to you, and you can say, oh, hang on, I'll just go and get my Greek, and then they get nervous. So I said, you don't know Greek, I barely know Greek, let's stop nonsense. Okay, let's have a look at this Romans 1, you heard it read. Now here's the interesting thing with the book of Romans. Verse 16, the Apostle Paul's talking about why he continues to preach this gospel. He just gets hammered and beaten up and whipped and hated for preaching. And in the end, it costs him his life, as he knows it will. He says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it's the power of God that brings salvation to everyone who believes, first to the Jew, then to the Gentile. That's the non-Jew. For in the gospel, a righteousness of God is revealed. Now, you could skip from that statement right to chapter 3, verse 21. Let me just read. I'll go from that statement right to this statement. For in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed, chapter 3, verse 21. But now the righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law, and on it goes and talks about it. So you could just drop verses 18 to chapter 3, verse 20, and linguistically it flows beautifully. You would just have no reason at all for there to be a gospel. It's true that in the end it's very hard to appreciate Jesus unless you appreciate the problem. And so this book will actually explain why it is that God goes to such an extreme measure, because there is such an extreme problem. And tonight, if you don't normally come to church, or if you've brought your friend to church, I'm going to do something absolutely hopeless. It's kind of sad, really. I'm going to talk about the wrath of God. And I always want, when you hear a word like wrath, you want to say it in America, the wrath of God. I'm going to speak about the wrath of God. The wrath of God, okay? It's not a huge theme in the Bible, but it's there. And this passage talks about it. See, God, the gospel has been revealed. Verse 18, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of human beings who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Now, wrath, you see, that one of the problems is most of us either grew up in families or have had experiences of anger from teachers or bosses. There was an uncontrolled, vicious, capricious, dangerous anger, where the anger was a sign of the person's weakness. They needed to go to anger management classes. And some of you will have been really badly hurt and seen your mothers hurt by violent, angry people. So it's really quite natural that some of us, when we hear the idea of God being angry, we think, oh, I can't bear that possibility. But stay with me for a few minutes. The Bible is really completely unembarrassed about the fact that God is angry, that Jesus is angry. And sometimes people will say things like, you know, Jesus was just a man like us. You know, he's sinful like us. He gets angry. As if you get angry, it's proof of the fact that there's something wrong with you. I want to suggest to you that's to not think hard enough about these questions. I want to tell you the story briefly of the good policeman. You may have heard of the good policeman. He works in America. And he's in town. And he sees a little old lady crossing the road, going to hear the Rolling Stones. And you've got her zither frame, and she's going across the road, doing okay. And then a car pulls up, loud music going, pulls up right next to her. These three or four guys jump out. They begin to be rude to the old lady. The good policeman's watching. He's a kindly man. They begin to be rude. They circle her. They begin to say terrible things to her. He does nothing. He's kind, and he's smiling at these young men and their good grip of language. And then some of them begin to actually push the old lady around, and then they push her over, and one of them kicks her. He hears the sound of breaking bones, and she lets out some noise, and they take her person, and they're just getting into the car, and the good policeman walks over to them and said, boys, I know you're full of testosterone and that, but fellas, that really wasn't the nicest thing I've ever seen done. And that lady, she's crying, and she's in a lot of pain now. And she was going somewhere. Now she's going to have to go to hospital. So, boys, I think we'd all prefer it. And you'll feel better about yourselves if you don't do that. You just might like to think about that. See, this is the good policeman. Now, this is a disgusting policeman, isn't it? That is a vile... right? To do nothing while people do violence to someone else, and to not feel anger rise within you, is not a mark of spiritual development. It's a mark of the fact that you're probably a moral leper. You've lost the ability to feel anger. Anger is a legitimate response to evil. Now, what the trouble with anger is, we very rarely use it rightly. So the Bible will say, be angry, but don't sin. Now, for most of us, that's very hard to do. For most of us, even if we get justly angry, the response is often sinful. But the Bible understands, the view of Jesus is that anger is a good thing in its right place. And there are times if you can watch something and not get angry, it is not a mark of your spiritual development, it's a mark of your apathy. And you don't care. a number of really important, wonderful, charitable works were begun in our world in the 20th century on an experience of anger. That people saw people being mistreated and no one doing anything, and they said, that has to change. Right? So anger is not something that we need to be ashamed of in God. We may be ashamed of our own anger. We may be suffering from the other angers of people. But God doesn't need a spin doctor, frankly, which is what some dopey ministers do. Not in Melbourne, of course, in Sydney. Where they're embarrassed about God, you know. Frankly, one of the problems, it doesn't matter what you do with God, he loses, right? People get cranky. The same people will tell me how wicked it is to speak about God being angry and judging. And then 5 minutes later, they'll be saying, and God does nothing. That's all these people suffering. He does nothing. So I think, what do you want? When he judges people, you hate him. And when he is patient and waiting, you hate him too. If you don't like God, it doesn't matter what he does. He's in for criticism. So this passage begins by speaking of the anger of God. Now, what is it that makes God angry? What is it that this wonderful anger is triggered by? Because anger is like the white blood cells. It goes where there's a problem. What's the problem? Well, it's not that last sad series of verses about people who hate and murder and gossip and lie. That's not what rouses God's anger here in this passage. Look at it in verse 18. The wrath of God is being revealed, this is in the present tense, is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and the wickedness of human beings who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Now, we don't have a ball here, so you can imagine. You've got to see this ball, basketball? Okay. This basketball? If you throw that basketball into a swimming pool, which you shouldn't do, but it's not good for basketballs, the basketball will have a tendency to float. Now, when I worked at a boys' school, Anglican boys' school for 9 years, the boys were not allowed, under pain of nearly death, to put basketballs in the swimming pool. But, of course, they did. And who could blame them, frankly? The school had 7 gazillion basketballs. And the boarders would... And sometimes you'd come up to the pool, I'd bring my kids up, and the boarders would be splashing and having a good time. And then suddenly someone would be sort of, and his mates would be looking at him slightly funny, and he would be kind of floating in a sort of uncomfortable way because he was holding the ball, trying to sit on it, and normally it could only last for a while, and they'd go, chung, and up would go, and he would go in. And because what he was doing, he was suppressing the ball. This is the word. It's holding something down with the measure of violence the word's got. It's what a tyrant does to his citizens. You oppress them. So what makes God angry? What rouses God's settled displeasure, which is what anger is when the Bible speaks of God's wrath? It's a settled, fixed, steady hostility to something. That's what it is. It's not raging off because you didn't get enough sleep or something like that. But that's what makes God angry is the way that human beings treat the truth. God is a truth-loving God. Truth matters to God. So what makes him angry is the human... You see in verse 18, we suppress the truth. We hold it under. You can do that. Its natural instinct is to bounce up like the basketball is, but we hold it under. Why? Because we are godless and wicked. There's something about the truth that we would prefer was not there. Well, what truth? Well, it's in verse 19. This is the truth which people don't like. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. So there's something about God, there's a knowledge of God that's available, and it's plain, it's obvious, it's like as plain as the nose on your face. You can see it, you can't miss it. And just in case there's any doubt about how plain it is, it's plain because, as it says there in verse 19, God made it plain. I tell you, when God makes something plain, it's plain. Right? The Father of Jesus, who's a very good teacher, is a pretty good teacher himself. So he's saying there's certain truths that God has made plain to people, but we suppress the truth. Well, let's look at verse 20, where it tells us more about this. What truth? How has God made truth plain? Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, which is one of the great problems with God, isn't it? He's invisible. His invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, which are just words that mean his godness, his eternal power, his divine nature, that he is greatly powerful, which is obvious from the universe, and that he is, there's this divinity about him, this godness about him. It's not telling you everything about God. In fact, there's a lot that needs to be spelled out. But the godness of God, the fact that he's there, the there-ness of God, it's been clearly seen. Now, the apostle here is doing a little wordplay. The invisible qualities of God have been clearly seen. Right? He's not being a fool. He's just speaking and teaching powerfully. He's saying, you can see invisible things. So you can work out, let me give you an example. You can work out, I've got a larger stomach. You can't see it. I could just have padding around my six-pack. But I don't. You don't actually see the stomach, but you can see this boy's done some eating in his day. Right? And you can see the invisible, can't you? And you can see that I'm still alive, can't you? I want to say, you can even see I've got a brain, although you can't see my brain. You may think it's weary or intoxicated or damaged. You may say all sorts of, but you can see all sorts of things that you can't see. Only the really silly person says, the unreflective person says, I only believe what I see. That's a ridiculous statement. That sight is brilliant. But and so what he says is, what God is... I keep wanting to use that American word for anger, but I won't use it. But what he's not happy with is that he has gone to a lot of trouble to make certain truths real clear. And we go to a lot of trouble to suppress the truth. So he's made the invisible obvious to us. How has he done it? Verse 20. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen. And then he uses the word that goes from the image to the reality. Being understood. That's what... Being understood from what has been made. So you can look at that which is made and you can see that there's a maker. Now, if you've done philosophy at university, you've also been taught how to dismantle that argument. Right? But let it sit there for a moment. What it's saying is that since the creation of the world, it's been screamingly obvious there's a creator. Right? Same like when you run into a poem, you might never run into a poem before, there's a poem maker. Same when you walk into a, you know, we instinctively know this, even if we've been taught not to believe it. Humans instinctively know when you see something ordered and designed that there's been some intelligence behind it. And one of the things I enjoy about listening to Richard Dawkins and a few of the other guys about how everything about the creation looks just like someone designed it. Everything looks, you know, except for one or two things that we can mock. You know, but it all looks as though, it's a trick. You've been tricked. And that's possible. The other possibility is that what looked like something that was beautifully designed might have been beautifully designed. People can we argue that one around a bit. But what does at least hear the argument, it's saying that God has made it crystal clear by what he's made. It's understood. They know. Now, how's he done that? Verse 20. From the creation. That's how we understand it. Now, when Aquinas and these other guys, a gazillion years ago, put together what we called the proofs, but he didn't. Any half-decent Christian thinker never thinks that there are the four or five proofs for God. They tend to be a phrase that the atheists use of them, and therefore it's a self-destructive thing. Because Aquinas knew it wasn't proof, but they were pointers in that direction. I'm always interested, too, when my daughter did... She did a week of university, too, before she left my youngest. I was the youngest in my family. There's a pattern. But she did philosophy. And, she did a week of philosophy. And the guy began to argue with Aquinas's five proofs. I think, seriously? Seriously? You think Christians haven't done any thinking in, 900 years? I mean, if I, picked on some atheist from around, 1200 and said, ho, look at that foolish argument. I think, no, surely you argue with the best. No, only if you're fair. Christians never suggested that the five proofs were proofs. We now do sometimes use it but it's basically an invention of people who want to send them up. But there are just clues, is what they are. A success. It's the same way. You know, if I went into that room and as I did before to get a glass of water, and there was some noise, and then you came in and I was dead on the floor, and there was a knife around my throat, etc., etc. You know, it could have been an accident. It could have just come flying through the window, and I could have just done it. In the end, what you do is the police would come in, and they'd use forensic science. And normally, it'll be a bit of this, and 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 the best reading of that. We didn't see it. But all the evidence points in that. And that, this is, it's a cumulative case. It's not 10 bad arguments equals one good argument. It's a bunch of arguments that all point in the, in, all well point in a direction, but they don't actually prove something. In fact, as you probably know, you can prove almost nothing, if you want to use the word technically. You mean, I can't even prove to you I'm here. This all could be like the Matrix. You're just having a bad trip in the Matrix, right? Where I'm having a lovely trip in the Matrix, right? You can't prove, except in maths. You know that book. So when people say, prove God's existence, I think, oh, grow a brain. You can't prove almost anything, right? Except in maths. In maths, you can prove things, except the axioms that maths is based on. We can't prove the axioms, but once we've got the axioms, if we just take those on faith, which we're pretty sure are right, but we actually can't prove, you can prove almost nothing. But you can just show, this is really, all the evidence points in that direction. And it works the same way with God. And the sort of things people bring up are, is why is there something and not nothing? Lawrence Krauss, yesterday, was one of the speakers, a brilliant communicator, absolutely rollicking good fun. But I said to a few of the atheists, my fellow atheists, I said, you know what I find disappointing about this convention is that there's no serious debate or discussion. So I would have thought, instead of letting Lawrence Krauss get up and do his stuff, his own particular reading about how everything started, there are a bunch of quantum mechanics and quantum theorists and theoretical physics who actually think Lawrence Krauss is talking rubbish. But they don't get a voice. I would have thought if we were seriously engaging in honest inquisition to the nature of the universe, to have one guy who's just got a new book out on something which he's selling, you know, doing everything he can to sell, let him get up and preach to us for 40 minutes and to say things like, science has shown, anyone time someone says that about something in terms of theoretical physics, you want to, yeah, what are you selling, right? But I thought, have another atheist scientist get up and ask questions. That would have been far more informative. But why do we get Lawrence Krauss up? Because he says what we want to believe if we're atheists. That is, that you can get something from nothing. Although if you listen to it or read it, he's just playing silly word games. As some of his critics, I was surprised how obvious it was. Even I could pick it up. He would speak about what we thought was empty space, and now we know it's not empty. So he's saying, you see, nothing is not nothing. No, it's because we know it's not nothing anymore. Like, we used to think the electron was the smallest particle. Now we know it isn't. The smallest particle is not the smallest particle. Well, then stop talking about it as the smallest particle. We know it's not. And terra nullis was rubbish. The land was not empty. Right? Oh, the empty land wasn't empty. That shows that the emptiness can have something in it. No, it just shows what you used to think is baloney. Right? So, but why does Lawrence Krauss get up? Because one of the hardest problems that atheists need to deal with is this. The Big Bang Theory, most of you will know this, the Big Bang Theory was there was really good evidence for that about 30 or 40 years before the scientific community finally accepted it. Why did they resist it so hard? Einstein admitted later on he messed with his maths to avoid it. Because nobody wants a universe that starts. The argument was that we had an eternal universe. It didn't need an explanation. It didn't come into existence. It doesn't need a cause. You know, the scientists from the day, the name Big Bang was a mocking name. And you can read some of the great scientists of the time, Hoyle and others like that. They hated this thing because it gave comfort to the religious. Because where does the Bible start? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. If something's eternal, you don't need to, by nature, if something's eternal, it doesn't need a cause. But the way it works is basically this. Everything that comes into existence has a cause. It's the basis of why we do science, because we always say, why does that happen? Why does that happen? Why does that happen? Back we go. Everything that comes into existence has a cause. The universe comes into existence, which we didn't used to think. Therefore, the universe has a cause. Right? What is it? And that is why physics has got a lot more people who believe in God in that area than biology does. Because physicists have felt pushed by some of this stuff. Now, that's why Lawrence Krauss is given a free go at us all, because in the end, he's got a little theory, and he's clever. I mean, he's a gazillion times cleverer than I am. But, you know, in the end, his critics are right. He's partly playing word games, right? That what 100 years ago we thought was empty simply isn't empty. Well, then we don't call it empty anymore. We grow up, right? But why is there something and not nothing is one of the great questions that needs answering. The fine-tuning question, you can look this up yourself, that there are four or five great central constants, the weak nuclear, the strong nuclear, gravity and electromagnetic force, but there's about another 11. And people have noticed that these forces are so finely tuned in a way that is just freakish. That, again, it has driven quite a number of physicists to say, well, as some of them said, it looks as if someone has monkeyed with the maths. It's so perfect. Why is it something and not nothing? Why does it seem so fine-tuned? Anthony Flew, and it was one of the things I'm going to write to the guys, say, you know, at some stage you should answer Anthony Flew. Anthony Flew was the leading academic atheist in the last third of the 20th century. We heard Bertrand Russell quoted a few times. He was the guy before him. No one quotes Anthony Flew. Why? He disgraced himself. He was in the middle of an academic... And Anthony Flew actually changed the arguments. The new atheists, as they're called, Dawkins and Dennett and Harrison, poor old Christopher Hitchens, they've contributed not a single new argument, not one step forward in the argument for atheists. Anthony Flew did. He's made life much harder for us who believe in God. But in the early part of the 21st century, he was in a debate, at a three-day serious academic debate, which goes on the question, the philosophical question of the existence of God. Halfway through the debate, he came out and said, friends, I'm sorry to tell you the debate has to finish. I'm now convinced there is a God. Well, didn't that send old Richard into a flap? Right? He used a very long word, which I looked up the dictionary, it just means traitor, and accused him of just getting old and stupid. And I thought, beautiful, let's invade ageism rather than deal with the arguments. But one of the things that got Anthony Flew was this. It was the fine-tuning argument. He said he's always, even when he was an atheist having a go at us, he has a great teller of parables. He said, imagine you go on a holiday and you get to the place and you go into your room and playing through the sound system is your very favourite piece of music. On the wall are your favourite copies of your favourite artworks. You think, oh, this is lovely. The sheets and everything are just your favourite colours. You go into the bathroom and there's your favourite cologne, right? There's your, you know, it's, and you go, wow, this is amazing. You go, and there's the new book from your favourite author. Now, at a certain point, Anthony Flew says, you go from thinking, wow, that's a happy, wow, boy, that's good luck. Boy, this is creepy. Somebody knew I was coming. And Flew said, for him in the end, it just became harder and harder to keep pretending. Wow, well, that's handy. Ooh, that's handy. That's handy. Who'd have thought, right? And in the end, he had to decide what was stretching his capacity to believe that it was a logical explanation. In the end, the fine-tuning argument plays along that way. The other one, which we don't use so much nowadays, is the argument from design in life. And this is what Darwinism, in the way it's used, has sort of destroyed for many of us. And I have Christian friends who are saying, Ian, stop talking about how wonderful birds are, you know. Flying birds, okay, just in case you think I'm using a 60s description of women, right? Birds, you know, with their hollow wings and their breathing system that's nothing like ours, that they've got a whole different way that they get air in and out, and the feathers and all this stuff. I mean, you get to a point you think, really? And I understand the theory. Richard Dawkins tend to say if someone is not persuaded by it, they just don't understand. No, we're not all fools. It just in the end, there are certain points you say no. And I want to suggest to you, this happens repeatedly. One of my dearest friends, who I saw just the other week, was an atheist when I became a Christian. Always a man of terrific intellectual rigor. So he would sort of MC the debates in the pub after I became a Christian. And I remember him sometimes saving my bacon from some things. Yeah, that's an illegitimate argument. And anyhow, he went out and did medicine, dropped into my house a gazillion years ago, and said, we went out and had a beer, and he said, guess what? Because I was a youth worker and we had people dropped in, so we thought, if we're going to talk, we need to get out. So we went up to the hotel. And Randall said, guess what? I said, what? He said, I believe in God. I got all excited. I said, don't get too excited. He said, I'm not a Christian. Right? But I just, it, and as we talked, he said, the more I studied the body, he said, the more and more foolish it became to believe that it was all an accident. He said, you might believe the pancreas could be an accident, but the liver as well, and the brain, and, you know, like, he said, and it's all happening so wonderfully. I won't tell you the story of my next door neighbor, who's a bottom surgeon, but when he speaks about what the anus can do, it's amazing. And he, you know, And we had a discussion, you know, it's all happening wonderfully. I'll tell you about it later on if you want to ask. But and I challenged his atheism on the basis of his area of work. And it was an interesting discussion. And I think, like many atheists, in the end, he wasn't an atheist. He liked to call himself an atheist. He was actually an agnostic. He just said, I don't think you're right about God. So I said, you're not an atheist, are you? You're an agnostic. He said, yeah, that's probably right. But he kept on saying he was an atheist. It was very interesting. I said, why do you want to call yourself an atheist when you're not? But he just never seemed to get over it. Clever guy, smarter than I am. But anyway, so people still look at the creation and go, phew. But here's the other thing. I reckon that although evolution does seem to explain the diversity of the species, which is all Darwin asks, he never suggests, as some people naughtily suggest, that Darwinianism explains the origin of life. It doesn't start to. It only begins to explain things when you've got self-replicating, you know, DNA, and it can mutate and stuff like that. It doesn't get close to the origins of things. It does tell you, though, why there's such a diversity of species. If you know, that's what the theory does fairly adequately. But it's just used illegitimately. Well, the question of the origin of life is solved, but Darwin solved it. No, Darwin doesn't. This is one of the things that Anthony Flew drew to our attention. But I suggest to you that if we had better microscopes when Darwinianism was being embraced with such vigour as a whole-of-life theory, it wouldn't have caught on. Because they looked at what they used to call simple life and simple cells. They still called it that when I was at school doing first-level biology, or 2F biology. Because all they could see was a membrane with fluid in it. And it looked very simple. If that's where life starts, I mean, you know, that's easy. It's a couple of accidents. There it is, membrane, fluid, boom. And amoeba to Ian is a fairly small movement, right? That's a fairly small movement. But non-life to amoeba, that's a flippant. That's where the miracle, that's the giant leap, right? And so if they could have seen what we now can see in simple life and see how extraordinarily complicated it is. And I went through this once at UTS in Sydney, and I was, you know, having this argument, and just I mentioned some of the things in it. There's various things that are prefabricated in one part of the cell and then carried on little trucks to other parts and put together and used. And it's breathtaking. And it's all nanotechnology. You know, we generally speaking think if you do something big, that's good. If you can do it really small, you're really super clever. This is all happening, you know, nanotechnology, very, very small. But I'm making this comment. A bloke comes up to me afterwards and says, I've just finished my PhD on simple life in the cells. I'm going, oh, no, have I just blown myself? You know, and he said, I moved from being an atheist to a believer, and I'm now a Christian from the study of it. Because, and I think that's why the notion that they kept saying at this conference was that Christians thrive, Christians don't want people to think. It's just not like any Christianity I've ever known, either when I wasn't a Christian or subsequently. What we're saying is, let's think. Let's look at the evidence and work out what is the best explanation. What the Bible's saying is, it's clear. And God has made it plain. But what do we do with it? Well, verse 21, this is why God is not happy. Although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile, their foolish hearts were darkened. They claimed to be wise, but they became fools. And here's the word that gets used again and again now, for three times it'll be used, and they exchange. Humans do a swap. Verse 23, they exchange the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal human beings. So we, instead of worshipping and honouring the God from whom it comes, the glorious immortal God, we pay attention to the creation and we turn some of those things into God. It's said again in verse 25. They exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator, who is forever to be praised. Ben Elton was the comedian, one of the comedians on Friday night. He was brilliant. But he talked about the fact that since we've traded in God, a lot of his friends, he said, worship their kids. So we've actually simply turned our, you know, our focus of worship and action and service and dedication from God to our children. Now, he's not saying you shouldn't love your kids. But I've heard people speak about family idolatry. I think it can be a cruel thing to say. But there's an exchange that humans do. We don't, in the end, leave nothing in the central place of human life. Humans have to revolve around something. You can be a narcissist. You can be a family idolatry. But there will be some organizing principle. The concern God has is that we say we will believe anything rather than the obvious. And so we remove God out of his universe. and we pretend it's terra nullis, to go back to that phrase. We pretend it's nobody's universe. Right? And it's as much a pretense when we do it as it was when our ancestors got here. Well, let's look lastly, the weird way God's anger works out. We've looked at the wonderful fact that God gets angry, about the abuse of truth. Well, that's what makes God angry. How does he work it out? Normally, the Bible speaks about wrath as something in the future. God's anger will be dealt with when Jesus returns, as he promises. But here, it's happening in the here and now. God's anger is revealed. Now, what is it? It's in verse 24, verse 26, and somewhere else. 24, 26, 28. It's this little phrase. Therefore, this is God's response to humans. Humans say, we don't want you. Get out. Verse 24, this is how God's wrath works. Therefore, God gave them over, or God gave them up. Verse 26, because of this, God gave them over to shameful lusts. Verse 28, so God gave them over to a depraved mind. Now, this is not what people think. They think God's going to throw it. What God basically, here is when you begin as an individual or as a culture to experience the wrath of God. It's when God says to you, that's what you want? You want to pretend I'm not here? You want to pretend the universe is terra nullis? You want to take something else as your God? Okay. You can have it. I give you over to your depraved mind. I will cease troubling you. You can have it. You want me to leave you alone? All right. One of the most terrifying things possible. I know as a Christian, when I am able to sin and not feel bad about it, that's when I get really worried. Because if God stops worrying us, if God stops, you know, being a pain in the neck, if God stops hassling us, that's the point to get really anxious. And what God does in his anger is he says, you don't want me? Really? You sure that's what you want? Okay, on your way. And God gives people over, it says, to we become slaves of our sinful nature. In verse 24, in verse 26, we become slaves of shameful lusts. And he gives us over to have a depraved mind, a mind that is broken and twisted. And we'll think foolish things. Although it might have a magnificent capacity, it will believe all sorts of nonsense. Now, because I've, and I need to finish at some stage, according to this passage, if there's a God, why are there atheists? It's not fundamentally an intellectual problem. It's a problem that we actually don't want God. We would rather pretend it's terra nullis. But here's what I think happens for us. I don't suggest with my many atheist friends that they're all deliberately fibbing. I think what humans can do is, if we believe a lie long enough, we believe it. So at some stage in the Power family history, a lie became part of the story. That is, that I, in my vigour as a 10-year-old, could actually had once got the swing at Catherine Park, which is the park just up the road, that I'd got it so, because I would go the highest of any of the kids. That I had once gone so high, I'd gone right around. And I believed that for many decades. And then one day I was thought, that can't be true. It's just physically impossible. The amount of... I'd need a rocket pack. But I absolutely believe that. For me, I mean, you might think, oh, you are a fool, aren't you? But maybe. But it just... It interested me that at some stage as a kid, I came home and told my parents. I was the youngest of five. I was the cutest. And they just all... yes, they... And I think they probably all knew. And this story went on and story went on until eventually... I do think humans can do that. You tell a lie to yourself long enough, and in the end, you actually think it's true. But what God is saying, here's my problem. I've got my dear friends who are atheists, and they're good people. They're clever, etc. And some of them I know fairly well. They're fairly honest people, as far as I can tell. And I sit across the table, and we just look at the same evidence and come up with completely different conclusions. And I'm thinking, they're not fools. I'm not a fool. I have no, I don't think they're deliberately being sneaky. I'm trying to be as honest as I can. But I think what this is saying is, in the end, if you insist on suppressing the truth, do that long enough, exchange it for a useful lie, and God will give you over. It's frightening in the end. and that God in mercy will then shake us up. I've seen this repeatedly. I've got a number. I've got one, two, three, four separate stories here of people I've known who were dead set keen atheists, including myself, who, when they changed, I'll just tell you one quick. The guy who was the founding father of the Macquarie University Atheist Club back in the 70s came to an event not at all aimed for him. It was a bunch of country teenagers, and he was, you know, and he turned up, and I was really sorry he was there. In fact, I was praying that God would take him out of the room, because it was the one thing in the 10-day program we were talking about hell. I thought, this is like a send-up, frightening teenagers. Anyhow, God didn't take him out, and later on that night, he had a long conversation. He became a Christian. So the next day, we went out with these teenagers, and he came with us, and we were in a boat. And I said, mate, I guess you've got a lot of questions, you know, that from your years as an atheist that you probably want intellectual answers for. So let's talk. Where would you like to start? He said, no, they were all crap. He said, it was all baloney. He said, I just didn't want there to be a God. Now, I don't know if he saw that beforehand or not. But one of the comedians who finished the program last year, 2010, the global atheist thing, said this: I'll choose to live life my way. I won't let any God or gods tell me how I should live. This, I want to suggest to you, is the fundamental problem. It is actually the problem of sin. We don't want a God like that. Now, a little harmless God we can do with, but not a serious God who thinks he owns the universe. This is picked up in John chapter 3, when Jesus says, this is how the judgment works. The light has come into the world, but people prefer the darkness to the light. So far from God being a sort of a wish fulfillment thing, God is much bigger and gnarlier than that. He is much better than my atheist friends ever seem to get. But we don't invent it. Psychologically, it's just as logical to say they invent the non-existence of God to avoid judgment. If we want to play the psychological games, it just happens that chronologically, God got in first. Before Feuerbach said that that Christians project, God said humans repress. And my problem is, I can't see them doing it. Well, not, I can't see inside their minds and hearts to see them doing it. I hear the way in which they resist sensible logic, and I think, why can't you see? So that's, I'll stop there so we've got some time for questions, and then I might finish up, because I don't want to be thrown out of the building.